or sitting in judgment on other human beings, gradually these attitudes react. The person who is too critical loses his friends. The individual who is intolerant has a broken family on his hands. And one by one, the good things of life are killed out or suppressed by this constant nagging or this constant fault-finding. What does this do to the health? Practically all of the classical forms of health, and many of the modern, especially since the rise of some schools of idealistic psychology, almost any physician, any psychiatrist or psychologist, will tell you that a bad disposition is the heaviest burden that flesh must bear. The individual with the greatest chance of having a happy and healthy life is the one who is by nature kindly, generous, and optimistic. This doesn't mean that the kindly person cannot suffer occasionally or will not have moments of difficulty. But it does mean that if the grand pattern of life is friendly, health will be better. There is less likelihood of high blood pressure. The functions of digestion will not be so interfered with. Hatred, suspicion, condemnation are toxic, and they are more dangerous than any microbe that we could possibly run against. Everything that destroys peace of mind threatens survival. And too many people have suffered from lack of this type of personal integration, which overcomes this type of problem. Now, you will find, and I realize that the mind might bring this up as a strong defense, that you will find people of very advanced years who have nasty dispositions. It's not necessarily limited to the young. Nor does the disposition always cause the person who has it to drop dead. What it does do, however, usually, is make the individual who has it wish he could drop dead, an attitude which may be shared by his associates. To live along without some form of internal peace is simply to prolong the process of dying. The individual dies the moment he cannot face life cheerfully. And the dispositional factor is too dangerous to be endured in these times. We all need peace of soul. We all need quietude within ourselves. We need a unity of our own resources, that this inner part of our own lives will not betray us and will not keep us in a constant state of agitation and annoyance. Actually, the Oriental discipline of Zen has been a great help to many people, although it's perfectly possible to practice this type of thought with any religion. In fact, every religion is basically founded upon it, because every religion is founded upon the dignity of peace. And wherever peace is violated, the true spirit of faith is lost. So to try to work out these problems, you have to a measure at least, reduce the temptation to annoyance. Now, I've talked to people about this, and they say frequently that they love to do that if the other person would stop annoying them. It always moves to the other person. But no one person can be annoyed completely by themselves. There's an old Zen koan about that, and in which it says something about the master telling the disciple, "Now clap your hands together." The young man did so. After a few moments, the old master says, "Now clap one hand." And the youth didn't know what to do about it. But the two people involved in an annoyance cannot function if one of them is not annoyed. And if you can't change other people, and you can't usually, you are the one who had best not be annoyed. And you can escape annoyance in many ways. First, you can escape it on the grounds of its triviality. A little thinking and the annoyance may not be worth anything. Another way of escaping it is to consider that an interruption may not be a difficulty unless you permit it to be one. Another way of avoiding annoyance is trying to understand the other person and what they are going through. Instead of assuming that you are a very nervous, sensitive individual being abused by someone else, maybe you should think about them being the sensitive, nervous individual under great strain who does not have the strength of character to control themselves. If such is the case, then your strength of character should control you. Little by little, you can philosophize yourself out of a great many of these situations. But, of course, there's always this pile up in the background that all of the philosophizing is simply ways of trying to convince you not to do the things that you should not do. And the implication may not be strong enough. It is always there, this strange pressure within all of us. The pressure that goes back perhaps to the beginning of our human existence, or goes back far into the dawn of the forces which brought forth the humanity that we know today. That every part of the being seemingly is under the pressure of self-will. And as the Zohar says, because of self-will, so fell the angels. Self-will is the will to do what you want. And some way it must be brought into harmony with the divine will, which wills that you should do what is necessary. Necessity is the final guide. And necessity tells us that only through integrity can we survive. If you have some of these little problems that are annoying you, you can start in by settling quietly down somewhere once in a while and try to think through one of these problems. Why do you have these antagonisms against people? What have these people done to you that causes it? Sometimes the antagonism is simply due to an editorial you read in the newspaper. Sometimes you have been convinced by the commentators that there is some group that you are justified in disliking. You always have the right to censor your associations. If there's something you do not believe in, you do not have to say that it is right. Nor do you have to follow a certain Pollyannish idea of trying to see good where it isn't. This is not required. The thing that is required is that if you cannot support it, leave it alone. If you do not understand it, put it to one side until you do. Do not agree with anything that is wrong, but do not allow yourself to become emotionally involved in prejudice, criticism, and condemnation. It is one thing to quietly say, this I cannot accept. I cannot accept it because, and then give yourself a good reason. This is perfectly right. But when you dramatize it, get yourself all worked up over it, try your best to force other people to join you in the attitude, and also, when it comes to exact discussion, find you cannot support your own position, then it is best to relax and save your energy. I heard quite an argument not too long ago about two very opinionated people. And it reached the shouting standpoint. Of course, in our culture, you don't go beyond shouting unless you have strong political feelings. But in this case, the argument suddenly stopped in the moment, in the middle of something, and one said to the other, prove it. Where did you get this idea? What does it come from? Prove it. The other person couldn't prove it. They were 2 hours of argument far away from proof. It might have started with a small bit of evidence, but by the time the question came along, the evidence was forgotten. It was pressure, force, the inevitable belief that if someone makes a statement, we must object. So when you are in problems with some of these problems, prove them to yourself. Before you dislike someone, sit down and make sure you have some kind of proof, and that this proof justifies your attitude, and why this proof would prevent you from finally understanding this other person and seeing if you cannot remedy the error that exists. For in many instances, it's your own prejudice only that is causing the fault. All these little tricks you can use on yourself to try to lower this tremendous determination to do exactly as you please. It is almost always proof that whatever you believe is not as strong as your attitude. A religion is not an attitude. Religion is not a creed. You can join any religion in the world and accept its creed and do nothing about it. A religion is a way of life in harmony with divine principles. What a person claims religiously may mean nothing. Nominal membership in a religious organization which says salvation is to be attained only by joining that group has very little substance to it. It might help somebody for a moment, but it is one of those things that has to be ultimately outgrown. The actual practice of religion is the practice of the presence of God in conduct all the time. It is the realization that every thought that we have is either enlightened or benighted. And that if it is neither enlightened nor benighted, it probably isn't much value and can be forgotten. This attitude of religion is to be determined solely by the fact that religion binds up wounds. When it creates them, it is no longer religion, regardless of what it is called. We have had thousands of years of religious wars. We are threatened with more. We find individuals believing in the brotherhood of humanity can't get along with their neighbors. All of these people claim some kind of religion, or ethics, or morality, or integrity. But they cannot demonstrate it in daily conduct. And any religion which enables us to keep right on disliking everything we disliked before, criticizing everyone we criticized before, and continuing the pressured efforts to achieve our own selfish ends, while these things are present, whatever religion we believe is shortchanged badly. It's a matter of putting it to work. Now, putting it to work is not as difficult as it might seem to be. And I've known a number of instances in which putting it to work solved the problem. It's very important to a prejudice that it never confronts a fact. The moment the fact moves in, the prejudice is in trouble. A prejudice is not really a basic fault that we have discovered in something. It is an attitude that we have towards something. Now, if another person or situations are so morally or ethically delinquent that we cannot accept them or cannot reconcile with them, then the only answer that we have in most cases is to leave the solution to the law. The power of heaven will take care of it. The Chinese knew this long ago. Leave the impersonal, leave the impossible person to heaven. Karma, the law, will solve it. Great day by day, that impossible person will find it more and more difficult to maintain their own wrong attitudes. We cannot change other people. We can try, sometimes we can help a little. But if a situation is too deeply ingrained, the law must do it. We live in a universe in which law is ultimately benevolent in every form. There is no selfishness, there is no willfulness, there is no prejudice in universal law. The purpose of these mysterious processes of nature are that happiness, security, integrity, and perfection shall come to all that lives, and it will come. If we can help a little, that is good. But if we cannot help, there's no sense in hindering. So where we do have an opportunity, we can study to find out how we can smooth out our own intemperances or intolerances and prejudices and bigotries and find a way of life that is not only useful to us, but the final sermon. For the final sermon is example. We cannot expect children to profit from parental advice unless the parents are keeping that advice themselves. We cannot expect to be respected by our associates if we do not keep the principles we claim. We cannot help people in trouble unless we have demonstrated simply and clearly that we have passed through such troubles and have come through with a better and deeper insight. The end of all difficulty is to strengthen insight, to give us greater foundations, greater securities, greater bases for personal integrity. We can, therefore, set a good example. And if we are able to follow the golden rule, if we are able to follow the Sermon on the Mount, or its equivalent in other religions, we can then be at peace with those who would despitefully use us. We can return good for evil. But most people just can't quite get around to that. When they're hurt, they want to hurt someone else. When they feel they're unjustly treated, they must turn around and do an unjust deed in retaliation. This is not right. If you are mistreated, then the problem is to settle down quietly and find out what the facts are. It might be a common mistake. It might be something that has no foundation in depth whatever. But whatever it is, find out how you can face it with justice, but also with complete mercy. The quality of mercy is not strained. And in all things, justice and mercy go together. We can judge other people, but if we judge them without mercy, we are simply endangering our own blood pressure. It is very important for us to try to justify the minor mistakes of other people. When you find someone as a little unpleasant or a little uncertain in disposition at a certain moment, try to instantly and inevitably wonder what problem they are facing. Instead of taking the attitude that they're unpleasant, try to understand how perhaps you could do something to help them. Try always to keep a constructive point of view. If you can do this, you will gradually recondition your own ambitions. The greatest important fusion of good feeling that we have is a marvelous ability to transform ambition into aspiration. Ambition is the personality struggling for its dignities. Aspiration is the soul seeking truth. And this search for reality is finally the great journey of life. It's nice to have an adventurous career. We are none of us too fond of monotony. It is wonderful to have something to look forward to, something to build toward, something that will give us deeper satisfaction than we have ever known before. And in all cases, this is tied to aspiration. Aspiration is the impulse to become better, to become more like truth, to allow more of truth to move through ourselves. Aspiration is a continuous unfolding of becoming. It has nothing to do with the gradual accumulation of possession. It does not follow that aspiration must be poverty-stricken, but aspiration must be so dedicated that whatever it possesses is properly used. Ambition does not guide usage. Ambition does not protect the individual from the misuse of his own success. Aspiration does. Aspiration makes it possible for the individual to succeed harmlessly. For it does not make any difference in this world how much truth or insight we are able to gather. No one else is deprived of anything. No one else is cheated. And by our nature, we will never use constructive insight to exploit or endanger any other living creature. Aspiration protects us from selfishness. It protects us from the tyranny of ambition. It protects us from egotism. And it also opens the way to the final reconciliation of all religion. It makes it possible for the individual to see in all faiths paths leading to the final objective, which is the transmutation of the inner life. It is assumed that that which becomes like truth will participate in truth. That which becomes like soul will become soul. And that which is like God will ultimately become one with God. Anything that leads away from these basic achievements is not good. Now, we cannot expect anyone to change completely all at once. It'll take time to gain some of these insights that we need. But the beginning is to convince ourselves that we need to change, that there are processes going on inside of ourselves that are not worthy of us, that we are allowing ourselves to fall victim to an inferior part of our own composite constitution, and that this inferior part is centered in self-will, selfishness, arrogance, ambition, and greed. But all of these are unreasonable. As Buddha points out, these together are the causes of suffering. While they continue, there can be no end to suffering. The individual who is greedy never has enough. The individual who is ambitious sacrifices too much and still never fulfills his own ambitions. He may reach the high point that he wants, but he can only keep it a few years when another will take it from him. As one of the emperors of Rome, fearing that his successor would come along, tried to destroy everyone who might possibly succeed him. But finally an old sage told him very gently, he said, "Your Majesty, no man in the history of the world has ever succeeded in destroying his own successor. There will always be someone." In the same way, there is no amount of success that will enable us to prevent someone else from ultimately taking over the things that we have. The real answer is not in this accumulation or the building up of reputation or name. The real answer is the unfoldment of those values within ourselves, which in the end, naturally, result in a reputation that will never die. Because the greatest reputations in the world are those associated with the great teachers and benefactors of mankind. Jesus had no worldly goods and no place to lay his head. But all of the rulers of the earth at one time or another have bowed down to him. Buddha had sacrificed an empire, a country, gave up all his worldly goods to become a wandering mendicant. And as a result of that, he has become the most beloved person in Asia. Confucius was not practically penniless. He didn't have very much, but he lived a rather useful life. His last words were, "I have failed." Instead of that, he has become perhaps the symbol of the highest attainment of the Chinese consciousness. All these are not part of the passing reputation. They are part of the inevitable consequence of gaining divine merit. Merit in itself is the final source of all reputation, all honor, and all acceptance. And it may well be that the meritorious person will not live to see the result of conduct. It may be that the wise and thoughtful parent may not live to see the effect of its wisdom, insight, and love upon a receptive child. But that good goes on, not only to the child, but to that child's child, on and on through time. All good builds, all evil destroys itself. Almost everyone who has attempted to break the rules has finally discovered that the way that the life goes after rules are broken, that no man has really broken them. Each in turn is broken by the rules he sought to break. And in all these different procedures of living, the individual who keeps the rules is kept by them and goes on to fulfill the real purpose of himself. Materialism has limited our viewpoint on some of these things. Many people feel the only thing to do is to live while you're alive and get all there is all along the line. But it is a very temporary and impermanent state of affairs. And as we go along now, trying to live according to our present economy, which strangely enough is not very economical, we find every day things get a little worse. The more selfish we are, the more we all suffer. The more we grab, the more pain comes to us. The more we resent truth, the more our errors hurt. And this goes on and on. So every person can do a little something about it. Every individual can take a look inside of himself and try to clean the inside of his own cup. He can try to make sure that everything that flows out of him is basically good and constructive. And to remember always that it is far better to be cheated than it is to cheat someone else. Wisdom can prevent you from being cheated. But wisdom is the only answer when the time comes when you feel like cheating someone else. Then if your wisdom is great enough, you can withstand the temptation. Everywhere along the way, we can make little steps in the right direction. We can kind of cultivate things where we've had blank spots. Perhaps we haven't liked certain people or certain types of people, or we've looked down upon certain religions or faiths. Well, perhaps if we attended a few services of these other religions, we would understand them better. Wherever there is a tendency to dislike, make certain that you really understand what the matter is about. Very often, our dislikes are built on very inadequate grounds. They're on very bad logic. This idea that we dislike dogs because all dogs are like the one that bit us, this is a false attitude. There are some very fine dogs, and they may be the same breed as the dog that bit us. But it's also possible that we did something to excite that dog to bite us. If we didn't, then we have a right to say that dog was dangerous. But this does not mean that we shall declare all dogs to be dangerous. A member of some minority group cheats us, and because this one person has cheated us, all that group is condemned together. We don't like the attitudes of certain religious groups, but we do not realize that these attitudes, while they are supposedly common, may be quite unique. For in most cases, believe it or not, other religions are made up of people very much like ourselves. And all the various faults that we find in some faiths are not any deeper or more insistent than the faults in our own, which we have overlooked for ages. So everywhere work for reconciliation. And you will find that in this reconciliation, you will have fewer headaches and many fewer heartaches. You will have much better relationships with life. And you will have freedom from all of this wasted time and energy. Actually, mental pressure has as one very definite aspect, nervous tension. The individual gets nervous and excited and irritated and starts shouting and screaming about something when they're just nervous. And this nervousness is often associated with some small unpleasantness that isn't worth being nervous about. The individual, I've had many of them tell me that they do not know why they got nervous about it. But they just couldn't help it at the time. They were a little tired. Things hadn't been going very well. Then this small occurrence came along and it was just too much. If we quiet down our own inner lives, these kind of emergencies never happen at all. The most natural and easy way to complete any job is, in a sense, to allow it to complete itself. If we will just be quiet and let things move according to their own natures, we will save a tremendous amount of tension. Because the moment we get out of the way of a problem, that problem may solve better than when we stand between it and solution. So in every case where possible, where problems get a little tense or stressed, just quiet down. Pick up a book, read a couple of inspirational pages. Turn on a little good music. If you turn on the wrong music, your nervousness will go into a further depression. But pick up a little music. Look at a beautiful painting. Take a walk in the countryside. Do something to restore your contact with life. And recognize that we are all living in a wonderful universe that we are doing our best to spoil. And each individual lives in his own little universe, which he is doing his best to spoil. And the spoilage is becoming general. And we simply can't afford it. It is unreal, spiritual and cruel. So when the next time you have an idea that you've got to go out and gossip about someone, or you've got to tell for their own good somebody else all is false, or something of this kind, just quiet down and look inside and see if you can find the machinery and the wheels turning in there that make it so easy for you to follow that procedure. Find out if you can how you can transform the function within yourself so that it begins to cherish good, begins to look for good. It won't always find it. But in many cases, it can find good where previously it has found tension and stress. Here there is a certain value in constructive thinking. But constructive thinking too often is concerned merely with the gratification of some personal desire. We want something. So constructive thinking is to tell ourselves that we're entitled to it. Well, maybe it helps. It certainly does if the individual has a serious inferiority complex. But constructive thinking is not merely a form of self-gratification. Constructive thinking is the realization of the divine power in life. It's the realization that truth rules all things. It is the realization that justice is inevitable. And it is also realization that the greatest instrument for the achievement of the good we search for is to learn quietly, gently, and lovingly to love one another, to do those things which are kind and helpful. If we can sell ourselves this inside, we will find that our outer lives will be much more constructive, useful, and happy. And as we approach a symbol of resurrection, in the Easter Sunday that is to come, let us see if we can't restore something of the divine purpose in ourselves so that into this cup of our hearts can flow the blood of salvation, that we can become instruments for the dissemination of reality rather than to permit ourselves to be nagging little creatures. We have simply not claimed our birthright because we were born to do good. And as soon as we really realize that and start living accordingly, there'll be a lot more good in this world. Well, I guess that's all there is. But I'd like to make a special announcement at this time. On Good Friday, April 4th, at 9:30 a.m., the library is going to present one of my taped lectures. We're going to play a tape that was made some time ago on the subject of Zen and the harassed housewife. Now, that has, it seems to me, a kind of message that ought to be good for a major symposium of some kind. At 7:30 p.m. on Good Friday, there will be a showing here of two films, one on Petra, the red city of Petra, and the other on Ceylon. These two films will emphasize religious and philosophical elements. So you are invited to these two special activities on Good Friday. Thank you very much.